Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Before we get started, if you are loving this podcast, please be sure to leave us a five-star review and share this episode. Our guest today, we're so thrilled to have her. She entered the cannabis industry in 2017 when she founded Alias Can, a cannabis sales and marketing agency that helps cannabis cultivators get their products into more stores. But she didn't stop there. Since then, she has founded several other cannabis companies, including Terrapin Select and The Sales Joint. Please welcome Francesca Vavala. And as always, I am pleased to welcome back the Chief Knowledge Officer at New Frontier Data, the leader of our amazing research team, Mr. John Caguia.
Glad to be back, Heather. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, Francesca, you have a truly unique story that led you into the cannabis industry. Tell us a little bit about the history and the path that kind of took you to where you are today.
Sure, I'd love to. It's definitely not something that I grew up wanting to be, was a cannabis salesperson. I actually grew up wanting to be like my dad, who was a high school English teacher. And so I followed that path for a while. And that wasn't the Dead Poets Society ideal that I expected it to be. And so I ended up making a shift and following a more entrepreneurial spirit, I went into real estate. So I got into sales, I got into business, and I was really liking these aspects of it that were not available to me in education. And things were going well. I had no plans of leaving real estate. Unfortunately, though, a little bit of a history is that I was born a conjoined twin. So my sister Emily and I are actually the youngest successfully separated conjoined twins that in the United States. So we were 4 days old when we were separated at Johns Hopkins Hospital, and we were very fortunate to be connected at the abdomen, and the only major organ that we shared was the liver, which can regenerate when you're young and healthy. So we each got some liver, they performed this groundbreaking surgery, and we both went on to live. Unfortunately, Emily was born with a very severe form of cerebral palsy, which is a disability. It's not degenerative. It doesn't get worse or better. It just is a cognitive-based disability that manifests in physicality as well. And so she couldn't eat by mouth. She couldn't walk. She was wheelchair-bound her entire life. And it really wasn't a thing in our family. It was just how Emily was born. It was, part of how we grew up. It wasn't a hardship. It wasn't a burden. It wasn't anything like that. Emily was very much the light of our lives and strong personality and amazing, amazing person. And despite being separated, obviously we stayed very connected. But in 2013, she had a super bug, a kind of pneumonia that antibiotics couldn't fight off. And so she passed away when we were 31. And it was about 2 years after that, I think it was 2015, when I realized that cannabis had these antispasmodic properties to it. And that if I had known what cannabis offered medicinally, it could have changed the trajectory of her life. It could have improved the quality of it. I could even argue that it could have improved the longevity of it. And I felt very betrayed and crushed that I was taught growing up about how cannabis was this illicit, dangerous drug, when truly it could have been a life-saving, life-changing substance that could have helped her health. And so when I get mad, I turned that kind of anger into a passion. And I really wanted to make sure that nobody else had to suffer from the ignorance of cannabis that we had to live with. And so it really, I wouldn't say it was the sole reason that I got into cannabis, but it is the driving reason why I think we need to protect cannabis. We need to normalize cannabis. We need to erase the stigma of cannabis, and we need to respect it and do right by it, because really it's about what's available to us medicinally and even when we talk about recreational use, there's still a medicinal element to that I think we need to respect and not lump it all into people getting high for fun, which is not wrong. It is perfectly fine. But my passion really came from looking at it as a medicine that should have been more available to save my sister's life.
It's unbelievable. And, you know, we talk about these stories that really kind of normalize it and, you know, help people that maybe have these, you know, this outlook on cannabis. I mean, you're a perfect person. You're not this, you know, stoner that grew up. You're advocating for something that you feel like really would have changed your life and your sister's life.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. John, anything to jump in with or anything to add?
Well, first, just as a Hopkins alum, Hopkins.
Yes, yes.
I'm curious, you know, that what an extraordinary story, and I can understand kind of this seismic shift in perspective based on everything that you've been taught to having that light bulb go off. What has it been like trying to communicate this to your friends, to your family, to your community? The opportunity that you see in cannabis. What was that transition like as you began this journey or had this awakening? And then I had to go back to this community that had been so kind of hard set against cannabis to let them understand what the possibility and potential could have been.
That's such a great question. I've never gotten that question before. I love it. I think it was easier than I expected in a lot of ways. Particularly my parents were, you know, my entire family was 100% on board with this from the beginning, because we knew from a lifetime, you know, 31 years of trying to help Emily medicinally, that a lot of times what is a prescribed kind of treatment, a very in the box kind of thinking, didn't work for her. And we got to know her nuances, or we got to understand what actually did work. So this just became something else that was like a nuanced approach that could have worked. It just came too late. And my parents had no real hard feelings about cannabis. It just was something that they had also dismissed and didn't think of. So when we did start thinking of it, it was sort of the same light bulb moment of like, oh, well, gosh, if only, and what if? And in terms of the rest of the community, I really expected more pushback. And what I got was a response of curiosity of really, and compassion of like, oh yes, of course. And it almost felt like as soon as I was able to say, hey, I use cannabis, I'm advocating for cannabis, I think cannabis has so much good that it could do, suddenly I was hearing from people that I expected to either never hear from or hear opposing views from, saying, yes, of course. Oh, me too. Oh, I'm glad that you said that, because it was what I was thinking. It's kind of going back to the teacher role of, you know, ask the question because somebody else in the class has it and isn't raising their hand. So ultimately, there was also a humbling experience, you know, for me of like, I had to admit what I didn't know, what prejudices I had lived with and what assumptions I had made. And, you know, I went from being a high school English teacher that was, you know, I guess part of a system that kicked kids out of school for smoking weed. And now I'm talking to these former students about weed in a totally different way. So it's been a really healthy experience. And the response has been much more positive than I expected. Maybe that's because I'm not hearing from the naysayers and the people that hold fast to their stigmas. Maybe they're sheltering. But it's been overall really affirming to say, oh, the more I say this, the more people are feeling empowered to find their own voices, to do their own research, and to amplify the good that cannabis can do.
Amazing. Well, we touched on your marketing business, but tell us a little bit about Terrafin Select and the sales joint.
So Terrafin Select we started Alias Can, and my partner Mike and I started Alias Can because we were really operating in the sales space for, for his other business. And we were like, oh, well, you know, we do sales for engineers and manufacturers, people that are really good at making things and not so good at selling them. Maybe cannabis has the same issue. Growers and processors are really good at making things, maybe not so great at selling things. And we could be the sales engine behind their grows. And so that was the thought going into it. And even saying, well, maybe manufacturers of machinery, like we were putting it out there as we are sales for anybody in cannabis. And what we learned is we took on more clients of different kinds. I mean, everybody from machinery to CBD to growers to ancillary businesses, we really found our niche. And so one of those, there were really two. One of those was in CBD early on when it really kind of the 2018 Farm Bill passed and it boomed. We found that everybody was trying to buy CBD and nobody knew anything about how to evaluate it, what they should be looking for, how to use. They knew nothing. There was such a lack of education. So we created Terrapin Select not as another repeat, you know, redundant CBD brand or label, but as a reseller of CBD products that have been vetted, that have been tested, that meet a set of criteria that we created that said, okay, this is what, you know, quality CBD is. And here are the brands that we can trust on a manufacturing level, on, you know, a delivery level, on a quality and safety level. So Terrapin Select is really just a place where people can shop multiple CBD brands that they know have been vetted and tested and trusted, and they can buy products without being confused. There's not 50 oils that all do the same thing. We now can teach you about the difference between full spectrum, broad spectrum, and isolate oils, and, you know, why you might want to go with a flavored oil versus a, you know, isolate capsule. And so it's really bringing in that education piece in selling and saying, here's what CBD is, here's how you take it safely and wisely and to be well. So that was Terrapin Select. And then our other niche that we found was really working with producers and processors, those who are growing and processing cannabis and trying to move it into the retail space. And so Alias Can had been too broad. So we decided to create the sales joint that was basically the separate brand that was just for these growers and processors and focusing on them and creating opportunities for them to sell, to improve their sales processes, their operations, their brands, their marketing, all of it, so that we can be there just for that specific audience. Because if you're trying to talk to everybody, you're talking to nobody, is like the golden rule of marketing and sales. So we really know who our audience is now, who we're trying to serve. And the more we're into it, the better we can serve them. And it's great. We love working with people. So all of our clients have been challenging in ways and wonderful in ways, and that's cannabis. So yeah.
Amazing. Congratulations on your success. That's fantastic. And I agree. I mean, John and I talk, the most thing, there's so much education needed. It's just how to get that to the consumer or to someone that is curious about consuming. Yes. It's a huge step. Okay. Well, moving on, KOAT, Action News, reports New Mexico statewide cannabis sales down, but businesses still up for some dispensaries. So since rec sales began in New Mexico, the state's Cannabis Control Division reports nearly $13 million in sales. And while sales slowed compared to their first week, this new market is off to a pretty strong start. Francesco, what do you look for at the start of a new adult use market?
So the first thing we look at is the type of licensing that's allowed. You know, is it vertical? Is it limited? How many are allowed to be issued? What's kind of the cost of them? To what extent are growers and processors and dispensaries getting different kinds of licenses? How is transportation being handled? And then, yes, on the state level, there's legalization. But what are those municipalities, those cities, those townships, what are they doing in an adult use state? Because that can change in terms of how much is available or what kind of businesses are going to open and where. But that information lets us know what kind of sales are likely to happen. And that tells us also like the micro markets that are going to emerge. And the reason that we look at this first is because we need to understand the nature of the licensed businesses in order for us to offer the best kind of sales consultation to our clients. So that's definitely the first thing we look for, in addition to any kind of social equity efforts, because we always want to pay attention to that and make sure that legalization is serving or at least attempting to serve, you know, the communities that have been most affected by prohibition. So those are our kind of first criteria. Let's get the landscape of the state licensing wise. How many players are there? Are they able to talk to each other and sell to each other smoothly, or do they need some more help? And if so, what does that help look like?
Yeah, it seems like there's a ton of recon that needs to be done for each market.
Yes.
Don, anything to add to that as far as what to look at for a new adult use market?
Maybe I'll approach it from a slightly different angle. So one of the things we think a lot about is, what does the market actually look like on day one? So like when they're activating their sales, which is a bit of a variant of the market landscape, but what are consumers walking into once sales can officially begin? And so there's a few things there that we'll be considering. One is, what products are available in the store and how many stores are open for them to be able to get into. How wide is the delta between the pre-tax retail price and what's available in the illicit market? New Mexico is a really well-established medical market. They've been cooking with gas for many years. And so as you're trying to draw consumers out of the illicit market into the legal one, how much of a premium are they paying even before the taxes get applied? And then how much does the tax add to the consumer retail price over and on top of that? And so while you will always have long queues in a market like New Mexico, where people have been trying to get adult use passed for a really long time, they finally have it, people are going to be really bullish, and they'll be willing to pay that day one premium. I think it becomes a more compelling question to see how sales are performing in week three, week four, after that initial novelty has worn off. And are consumers coming back to repeat these purchases with these new legal products? We fully expect that New Mexico is going to be a strong performing market. It's a small state, but quite high usage rates within that state. They're pretty well oriented to the idea of regulated cannabis, because medical cannabis has been legal there for a while. But it'll be interesting to see how the next few months play out, particularly around the opening of access to retail locations in some of the more remote parts of the state. You know, it's one of these states that has a couple of major urban centers and then large kind of less populated areas of the state. There's a lot of tribal land in that jurisdiction, in that state. So all of these are going to be factors that influence the performance of the market beyond day one. And while we expect demand to be strong through the state, it's going to be interesting to see how some of these jurisdictional differences, as Francesca said, how some of these jurisdictional differences will play in consumer participation, as well as what happens after the initial luster and excitement of, hey, we've got legal cannabis. After that wears off, then what does repeat business look like in the state?
That's such a good point, talking about the premium and the taxes. But Francesca, there are probably going to be a lot of consumers that are experiencing their first legal sale. What do you think producers can do to stand out in the crowd?
So much. So much. They need to, because this question isn't being asked enough or early enough in legal states, because producers in every market are concerned with product quality and quantity and what they need. And that's understandable. But what I advocate for is to make product quality, of course, your first priority, and then sales your second priority, because that's how you're going to stand out. If you can have a professional sales approach to your business, and that means like a strategic approach that takes care of their entire customer pyramid, that means then you can build awareness to bring in new customers. You can have a brand that speaks to specific customer base. You can have messaging. And I mean, it's more than a logo. It's about your voice. It's about your imagery. It's about your colors. It's about your website, your sales collateral, your packaging, your sales practices. They have to align with who you are as a producer, because that's all informing the customers. And your customers, you have two as a producer. You have your retailers that you're trying to sell into, which is that B2B place. But also as a producer, you need to be selling to those consumers, not selling directly, but reaching them directly so that they know to ask for you. And the way you do that is by being consistent. If you are selling top shelf products, and you're in a really basic packaging with a barely functional website, then you're confusing your buyers. Are you about quality or not? And if you're the craft boutique producer that grows exotics and has incredible genetics and it's, you know, great profiles, but you have no literature that explains why that's valuable or how that's different. If you don't tell the consumer what it means for them, then you're confusing buyers. You know, are you offering something unique or are you not? And your sales, and not just the point of transaction, I mean everything that touches sales, you know, from your brand to how your salespeople interact on the phone or take orders or fulfill or follow up or interact with bud tenders or, you know, handle objections, all of it, and managing accounts, everything is sales. And that's what's going to make or break your business. Like, assuming that product quality and compliance are taken care of, sales becomes the patient care issue. Because if you are a producer that is only focused on product quality and your crop goes bad because things happen, it's a plant and we can't control everything, you've got nothing for your customers, but because they only liked you for your fire. But if you're a producer that's had this professional sales approach, which means you're operating on a relationship-based kind of business, then you're going to be able to get through bad harvests. You're going to be able to keep customers around for the next harvest. And so cannabis producers need to have a focus on a professional sales approach that is not just about product quality, but is about informing and educating and reaching their people. That's how they can stand out. Because if you become the producer who dealing with you on a sales interaction on the retail level, let's say, that should be as good of an experience as smoking your weed is for the consumer. That's how good that experience should be. That's how you stand out. Be agile, be personal, be professional.
It's so true. And I feel like the first thing people probably think of when you're going to a rec is just meeting that demand, you know, just trying to get that quantity out there. But, you know, I feel like we're seeing more and more. John and I had on a webinar recently. Philip Cousteau has a new brand coming out, and it's an impact brand. They're ocean advocates, and it's really tying back to this whole impact and how this, like, it's more of like a movement and what they stand for. And it's really, really, I think it really tells a really interesting story, and it's very clear kind of who their customer is going to be. It's someone that's, you know, advocates for that and is environmentally friendly and wants, you know, less of a, you know, carbon footprint and all that. So I think it's really interesting.
Yeah.
John, what would you say to that? Because I know we just had them on recently.
I totally agree with everything Francesca has just said. You know, we are facing a twin tension here. One is this idea of the commoditized flower, and this continues to be a flower-driven market. But also we're seeing kind of the rise and the imperative of branding and engagement in this market. You know, the good quality smoke, quote unquote, is not enough to get you standing apart in this market sufficiently or in a sustained way. So, you know, we have so many, particularly of the legacy producers, the folks who've been doing this for a while and really stand by the quality of the product as Francesca described it, who just kind of feel like, you know, I mean, I grew exceptionally high quality cannabis, it should speak for itself. But in an environment where consumers are really spoiled for choice, and the delta between the very top end of the market and the middle of the market is getting very crowded and getting narrower because, you know, the rising tide of quality is lifting all boats. It's becoming increasingly imperative that just having the fire, as Francesca said, is not enough. And so just riffing off of the points Francesca's made, I think branding is much more than just having a cool logo and a cool website. There has to be a compelling story there that drives engagement and resonance with the people who you're trying to sell your product to. Two, there has to be a great deal of authenticity to the brand that you're building. You know, for better or for worse, cannabis consumers seem to be very, very good at sniffing out things that don't sound legit. And so you may get away with it a couple of times, but ultimately, if you think that you're selling them smoke, pardon the pun, the ability to build kind of loyalty and longevity in this market is profoundly challenging. And then third, there's the reality about the way this market is evolving. You know, we've just done this cannabis consumer survey where we asked consumers how likely they were, or how interested they were in trying new products. And the vast majority of them were like, said they were really excited to try new products as they become available. Brand loyalty has not been cemented in this space yet. Consumers are excited to try new products as they're hitting their shelves. And so just because they bought your product yesterday doesn't mean they're going to come back tomorrow, because there may be a shiny new thing on the shelf that they want to try. And so it's really critically important that, you know, that brands think about moving away from this idea of really transactional relationships, relying on the bud tender to be the ambassador for your product, because, you know the guy well and he believes in your product. And finding ways and channels by which you can build that one-on-one relationship directly with your customer to stimulate this idea of loyalty and increase the probability that when they walk back in, even amidst a growing sea of product options available to them, that they'll come back to you and to your product, because not only is it a high quality product, but it's a brand that they believe in and feel deeply connected to.
Totally agree. And also, I think it's funny too, I feel like there's these novelty products coming out too that are, you know, something you want to try, but something you may want to even gift, you know, like the Mike Tyson ear bites. I mean, that's hilarious. You know, there's so many different angles that people are doing to tell their different stories. Francesca, any thoughts or predictions for other new markets coming online for the rest of 2022 and beyond, I guess?
I have given up looking into the crystal ball. It is cloudy at best, but I can tell you that I am very, very excited for what New Jersey can bring to the East Coast, for what New York might hopefully bring to the East Coast. There are two markets that their competition with each other is going to, I think, do well for consumers. It's going to help consumers. It's going to help, hopefully, business in general and the East Coast in general really normalize the kind of appeal of having dispensaries, having adult use markets, having all of that available. And truly, it's two markets that are going to be big and influential on the East Coast, which is where I am. And I find that exciting. I have a lot of hope, but I'm also cautiously optimistic, because I've seen how many, you know, different townships are limiting legalization in New Jersey, how slow everything is moving, even though there's a whole lot of big talk coming out of, you know, New York and New Jersey too. But I'm very hopeful that there's going to be some good done in both of those markets. And that's what I'm most excited for, proximity wise, and for the East in general.
Yeah, it's so funny. I feel like people that don't want it in a certain township, they think that they're going to keep cannabis out, but really it just strengthens the illicit market in that township. Yes. I mean, it would you rather have it regulated and in your town, or unregulated and getting it, buying it from...
And still in your town.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Tom, what are your thoughts on that?
So we've talked a lot, a bit here about kind of New Jersey, New York, which I think are really compelling markets. Virginia is another one that is moving quite mm-hmm. quickly. One that I'm actually now watching with greater interest is Maryland, which there's a interesting kind of legislative tension building here. Hogan, the governor of Maryland, is vying for potentially the presidency in 2024. And so him supporting cannabis, him supporting abortion, these are sensitive issues with the GOP primary base. So he's kind of sensitive there. But the Democrats do have a supermajority in the state legislature, and should have enough votes to be able to overrule his veto if he were to veto cannabis legislation, which is very, very very popular in the state of Maryland. And so the idea that, you know, we could potentially see Maryland pop as a bit of a dark horse coming into 2022, and it creates this, pardon the suppression, but Emerald Triangle in the middle of the eastern seaboard, with Maryland, DC, and Virginia all being legal. I think it poses a potentially really interesting kind of summer going to the fall, given how popular, you know, I'm thinking about the Maryland beaches, the Virginia beaches, are summer vacation destinations, given this is going to really put a squeeze on DC to do something about the chaotic mess that DC's market currently is. And you know, if both Maryland and Virginia go, then Delaware, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, North Carolina, I think we really have to start paying very close attention to this. Just because we are expecting very significant revenues to be generated by this kind of triad market. And it's going to really rethink, shift the narrative of legalization as you start looking at points further south and west.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what it does for the tourist population around here.
Especially because the East, it's so easy to drive from one state to another. I'm in Delaware and it doesn't, I mean, it matters if we legalize or not, but as soon as Pennsylvania legalizes, as soon as New Jersey legalizes, I'm good. So, yeah.
Totally agree. Just, John, we've talked about that too, just the ability to kind of cruise up to New Jersey for me out of Maryland, or it's really not a long trip.
Dewey Beach or Ocean City for spring break 2023.
You know? Exactly.
Win-win.
We're going to have a little competition for New Jersey there for sure.
All right.
Yes. Well, we are almost out of time, but Francesca, we give all of our guests the opportunity to give a shout out to someone in the industry that you think is doing amazing things. So you have the floor.
Well, thank you. I would love to shout out a fellow woman in the industry, a legacy grower, AC Moon, who is just an incredible woman. She has grown up in the illicit market. She has thrived in the legal market. She has innovated. She has been a grower, a manufacturer of Top Crops, which is a growing tent. And she is now running Indica Innovations. And she is just an incredible resource for any grower, producer, processor of any size and scope that needs really help with the culture of cannabis, the plant science of cannabis, the business of cannabis. Certainly, she's just fantastic. We just recently had her as a guest on our talk show Infused, and it was so much fun to talk to her, and I cannot applaud what she's trying to do enough. So AC Moon, Indica Innovations consultant, you got to check her out.
Will do, absolutely. Well, thank you both so much for your time, and thank you to our listeners for joining us at Canna Week. Again, please be sure to like, subscribe, hit the notification bell, and if you really love us, leave us a 5-star review. I am your host, Heather Wickline, and we will see you next time. New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.